You're about to enter into a new world of knowledge, curiosities, and high strangeness. This is a podcast of Straight Up Strange Productions.
You're listening to Mysteries and Monsters. I'm your host, Paul Bestel. On today's show, I'm delighted to welcome Lisa McSherry to Mysteries and Monsters for the first time. A witch, priestess and author who has contributed to countless periodicals and magazines over the last 20 years, Lisa joins me to discuss her latest book, A Witch's Guide to Crafting Your Practice. In it, Lisa breaks down the complexities of the eclectic American Wicca practice for all of us and shares her experiences, knowledge and good humour on this fascinating topic. But before that, don't forget you can support Mysteries and Monsters by signing up at patreon.com/mysteriesandmonsters. $4 a month gets you early access, ad-free episodes, and bonus content. You can also click the link in the show notes as always. Mysteries and Monsters is on all social media platforms. Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, and please subscribe to the Mysteries and Monsters channel on YouTube. You can also visit mysteriesandmonsters.com for news, episodes, and merchandise. A big thank you as always to Dean Bestel for his marvellous artwork. The show is produced by Brennan Storr of the Ghost Story Guys, and Mysteries and Monsters is delighted to be a part of the Straight Up Strange Network. So, let's join Lisa to understand the whys, the wheres, and the hows of how we practice our craft. On today's episode, I'm delighted to be joined by Lisa McSherry, a prolific author, practicing witch, priestess, and the founder of the Facing North online community presence. Lisa has been sharing her experiences for decades. In her beautiful new book, A Witch's Guide to Crafting Their Practice, Lisa offers a supporting guide for newcomers to this subject. Lisa, I'm delighted to welcome you to Mysteries and Monsters.
It is an absolute pleasure to be here, Paul.
Oh, Lisa, I'm very intrigued as I was nattering your ear off before we started properly. For someone that's sort of been brave enough to start speaking about this subject and interviewing people from around the world such as yourself, I'm always fascinated when I speak to people from North America about how they ended up gravitating towards the world of witchcraft or Wicca or whichever particular tenement of the faith that they follow. For you, Lisa, it's obviously very difficult for me because I understand that the whole parameters of different states are essentially often culturally almost like different countries in regards to how they see certain subjects. So for a young person growing up in the States, how did you sort of, I mean, I've heard you mention this wonderful phrase about coming out of the broom closet in regards to opening up and being honest about yourself and your love of this subject. So for you, was it something that you'd always been interested in, or was there sort of a touch point in your life that made you open your arms and embrace this subject and think, yes, this is where I feel myself?
Well, I will say that when I was very young, I was actually big into Catholicism. I was big into the ritual and going to church on Sunday. I felt like I had a very strong connection with God. And then as I grew older, it hit my teens, basically, I started to have a real problem with the religion of Catholicism. Still, I didn't have a problem with God. I had a problem with how I was supposed to practice, the rules for how I was supposed to practice. And I had a real, and I won't go into details, but I kind of had a real break with the church, if you will, and spent about a year looking, dabbling, talking to people, talking to Jews, talking to Buddhists, talking to Hindus. And I was very lucky because I was growing up in San Francisco, California. So I had a lot of cultures around me and a lot of resources to sort of easily talk to people about what they thought and believed. Mm. But I will say, I have to blame, ultimately, if you will, blame Starbuck, whose book, The Spiral Dance, was on my mother's bookshelves of all places. And my mother is not a pagan in any way, shape, or form. She's gone back to church, actually. But she had the book because it was feminist. and she was a feminist back in the 80s.
Yeah.
And I picked it up and I was like, what is this? And I read the first chapter and I fell into it.
Yeah.
And it was literally, as many people say, I felt like I was coming home.
Mm.
And sound of that year, I dedicated myself to the goddess and said, I'm your priestess. Tell me what to do and I'll do it. Just be clear. That's our deal. And looking back, I promised way too much. But I was, I think my youth was taken into account and I wasn't actually put through any trials for quite a while. And you know, had to prove myself and had to learn more. But then after that, it was just a matter of wherever and whenever I could, I searched for information. I didn't have a teacher. I was too young. Teenagers don't find teachers very easily. And often if you do, they're not very healthy teachers, shall we say. So I was picking up books. And I was very fortunate because Starhawk did in fact spark a whole lot of people writing and sharing information. And I could start, you know, Scott Cunningham came along and Ray Buckman. And, you know, there were more and more sources that I could find. And again, San Francisco, I could go to the library to find this. I didn't always have to buy these books. And so I was really self-taught until I got to college and then found myself working in a circle with five other women. And we shared responsibilities and we shared roles and we learned, we fumbled our way through how to do ritual. you know, lots and lots of, oh, that's what happens when you forget to call a quarter. Oh, what? How are we going to fix that? All right, here we go. You know, sort of bootstrapping in a very organic kind of a way.
Mm.
But I identified with the word witch real early on for a lot of reasons. And that was kind of my touchstone all the way through. In the late 90s, actually, my formal training actually came from somebody who was very eclectic Wiccan. That was my introduction to actual formal Wicca.
Mm.
And that was where I was sort of formally initiated and formally trained. And it was out of that that I came into my own and created my own tradition, which I've been doing for the last 20 years. So, but I've actually evolved back to realizing that I'm much more a witch than a Wiccan.
Mm.
I have deep respect for the traditionality and the lineage, but it's not my lineage and I was never formally in that tradition. So I give it its own respect and its own place, but I'm moving to a different place.
Mm.
And my feelings and thoughts and connection with deity continue to change. So if you were to ask me this question in another year, I might have a different nuanced answer. The core is the same, always the same. It's always the connection to nature. It's always the connection to the energy of what's around me and fitting in rather than making something, forcing something.
Mm.
Yeah, good way to put it.
Yeah. I think for someone who lives outside of the United States, it's very interesting to see how quickly modern Wicca sort of took off after the end of the sort of 60s in, as part of that countercultural phenomenon and also the rise of feminism in the area and the protest movements. It was almost as if it was calling to a lot of people who felt lost at that point in America, that they didn't feel that they fitted in anywhere and they were kind of on the margins of society, even though, Lisa, I suppose to most people, often we consider people who are marginalized to look different, to act different. And I'm never surprised when I meet people who you walk past in the street and you wouldn't bat an eyelid at them, and they will be practitioners of a variety of forms of Wicca or spiritualism based on their own personal beliefs. And it's often this misidentification of kind of outside of the box ideas or beliefs that people presume that these people will all be wearing a little badge saying, look at me, I'm different. Whereas I think for a lot of people at that point in American history, it's fascinating for me to see how quickly it grew across the nation, because obviously I think it was the sort of mid 80s that the US government actually recognized Wicca as a religion, which is a remarkable turnaround, because obviously Wicca sort of only really appeared in the 50s through the work done over here by Gardner.
Absolutely.
And others. So for it to have gained that much traction in probably about 20 years, I think that's often underestimated, that clearly there was a real appetite for this subject and these practices and the connections it was giving people at that point of their lives.
Yeah, absolutely. It's almost as if it was, you know, like yeast in the dough, you know, it just like, boom, there was some very fertile ground that was waiting for the seeds. And people brought the information and everyone just absorbed it and grew it. And what I find fascinating is the very American, I guess, in a kind of a classic. It's what people think of Americans as always very individual.
Yeah.
And so they kind of, a lot of people took the information and then said, and now I'm going to change it. We're going to do something different. And, yeah. Oh, that's nice, but we're also going to do this. And so one idea, one kind of way of practice, or three different kinds of ways of practicing, if you will, sort of turned into 30, turned into 40. I think, though, what's been interesting is watching over time that many of these new traditions that were formed, and, you know, had several covens, many covens, have kind of gone away.
Mm.
They've shrunken down. And there's good and bad to that. It doesn't mean that there was any, as far as I'm concerned, doesn't mean there was anything wrong with the tradition to begin with. It reflects more of a shift in how people find information, find teachers, frankly, the incredible level of burnout, and the number of elders over here, because they were just given way too much to do and no financial support. It's one way that witches are incredibly different from organized religion. You know, you don't have a tithe. You don't pay someone to do their job as a leader.
Mm.
It's a lot of charity. It's a lot of pro bono. It's a lot of, I will make time to do this. And, you know, people get tired after a while. And it's also attitudes and how people want to learn. You know, once upon a time, you learned by hanging out with somebody.
Mm.
And they talked and they showed and you learned what you could, and maybe they did some testing and you learned because you were in the room. And people don't have that much time anymore.
Mm-hmm.
They can't sit in a room with someone, you know, 3 hours a day for weeks on end.
Yeah.
Or, well, I mean, people have a hard time scheduling one ritual a month sometimes.
Yeah. For me, I think it's very interesting as well, this aspect that when I've spoken to a couple of other North American-based practitioners, Lisa, college seems to be where they realized they weren't the only person. Because obviously a lot of people weren't as fortunate as yourself to grow in such a metropolis as San Francisco. You know, a lot of people would come from the heartlands of the States and would end up going to these learned halls to carry on their education. And that, for a lot of people, was their first sort of exposure to that. And also that away from home, wanted to fit in. Once again, feeling a bit different to everything else that was going on. And perhaps they didn't want to join a sports club or the reading groups or whatever. And they sort of gravitated to something else. And I find it really interesting that certain American campuses seem to be hotbeds of people discovering this kind of kinship that they had with other people from around the States, regardless of where they were from or their personal backgrounds, that once they were at college together, they sort of clicked and suddenly realized that this was something that they, for somebody who said grew up in places like Montana or Ohio or North Dakota, they would never have had this kind of exposure to it until they sort of went somewhere else. So that for me is very interesting, that it allowed so many people from so many backgrounds to sort of realize this opportunity of collectiveness was there. They just never had the exposure to it.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, you know, for a long time, college was a really good place for people who wanted to meet other people who were pagan or witches or whatever they wanted to call themselves. You could just put a notice up on a community board and people who were interested would come. And I mean, that was like one of the main ways you actually met like-minded people for a really long time. That and the bookstores. You know, the metaphysical bookstores, you know, the little community notice. I'm putting together a group. We'll meet once a month. You know, it was this sort of underground pre-social network.
Yeah.
Now, that'd be really interesting. I should reach out to some people and ask what's going on the college campuses. I think there's a pretty thriving, I mean, for a while, there were actual pagan clubs. A good friend of mine ran one in Minnesota for the 4 years that she was in college, which astounds me because I can't imagine being that out, but she's a decade younger than, so that's a shift.
It is, because it's one of those things when you look back at popular culture, especially 70s and 80s, it was always, you've got to be careful with these, and people were always being led astray. And now we've got to the point where it's, I'm not suggesting that, I would still imagine, and it's probably the same in other countries as well. I don't wish to be negative towards certain parts of the US, but there will be certain areas where this kind of thing is still looked down upon, and people will twitch their curtains at such organizations coming together and organizing things, Lisa, and it still isn't as open and as accepted everywhere, but you can clearly see the change in the connotation of the words witchcraft or pagan or coven from what it was 40 years ago at the end of the 70s into the early 80s, because there was always, whenever you said those terms, it was always often deemed in a negative way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, certainly that's a really interesting dichotomy that you're pointing out, because yes, well, there are parts everywhere in the world that are going to twitch their curve. I like that phrase. You know, you also have major publications, magazines, they have astrology columns.
Yeah.
And, every year or so, they'll write a how witchcraft gets you ahead in workplace. And, the New York Times does things on the rise of neo-paganism in America. And I mean, so there's this fascinating level. I mean, look at how witches are now portrayed on television and in movies. I mean, yes, we had Sabrina back in the 60s and 70s, but now we have many supernatural. I mean, there's a bunch of shows that are live with, the idea of the occult and magic going on in everyday life. And that would have been impossible to imagine in the 80s, in the 90s even, which were far more open than the 80s in many ways. But you still have the dichotomy. You still also have, I've had plenty of students over the years who have said, oh, thank goodness you're on a line and I can be anonymous. Because if my neighbor knew that I was learning about witchcraft, I would never be able to go shopping again. I'd be stoned out of town. Not quite that bad. But
yeah.
I mean, really, people are like, I live in a place where there is no one around me for hundreds of miles. I could not possibly do physical training because there's no one to learn from.
Yeah.
And, and I think, and that's kind of an interesting thing in looking at Britain versus the United States. You know, the vastness of the United States is really kind of hard to grasp, even if you're an American. And because if you spend all your time growing up in like the Northeast, for example, that's practically one big metropolis.
Yeah.
You've got someone you can go to, a bookstore you can go to, one town over. But if you are in, Arkansas, you might have to go to an entirely different state.
Yeah.
Before you find anyone of like-minded or sympathetic or supplies, candles kind of a thing. And that's so very different from Britain, where maybe there isn't someone in your town, but I mean, you can basically drive the length of Britain in what, a day and a half?
If you stick to the speed limit, yes.
I don't know that I could drive the length of California in a day and a half at a speed limit. It's a real, the geography plays a very big role. But that's actually one reason why so many different traditions popped up. It's because someone got a mimeograph letter from a friend in New York and said, oh, look at this great idea. Look at this information. Ooh, okay. Spouse, let's do this thing.
Mm.
And so it's just the two of them for a while. And then they meet someone randomly who says, oh, I want to do that too. And but what they're jamming on and what they're creating is not under the aegis of anyone formal. They're just, maybe they're writing letters, maybe they're checking in with someone, but they're doing it like I did, bootstraps. They're figuring things out.
Yeah.
Maybe you're lucky. You get someone who really likes to write elaborate formal rituals and you get into a real theatrical kind of a practice, as opposed to somebody who's like, yeah, I just want to go sit under a tree, you know, which is just as magical and can be just powerful, but different.
Mm. Yeah, that's a very interesting point. Sometimes you forget that often these things would sort of explode in isolation, mm-hmm. and what was going on the East Coast would probably be vastly different to people's interpretations in the middle of the US as well as the Western side, all because they would all have different touch points that were inspiring them. They may have seen something on cable TV. They may have read a book. They may have had a trip somewhere, or like you say, even as daft as perhaps back in those days, it seems like a foreign language when we say some of these terms, Lisa, like a pen pal, or you visit a relative in another part of the country in a different state, and it might just expose you to things that you'd never ever seen before based on where you'd come from. Whereas, like you said,
plus also there were these families who had their own personal traditions of, they wouldn't necessarily call it magic, but they were tying themselves to the land. They had spirit workers or healers or woodwives, you know, people, you know, who had specific gifts.
Yeah.
And within the family, everyone in the family knew about it, but you didn't talk about it outside the family, which is its own kind of tradition and still exists to this day. But, you know, sometimes those people would meet, you know, more formal, what we would call witchcraft practitioners, and there's a whole new hybrid that would develop as the ideas generated and germinated. And that kind of brings me around to one of my absolute favorite things about witchcraft is the fact that it is so open to diversity.
Yeah.
And there's sort of like five core practices that if you just kind of get them down, everything you do from there can be your own, can be personal, can be what you need and can evolve, but it will still be under the umbrella, the very large umbrella of witchcraft, under the even larger umbrella of paganism. We're all pagans. We're all not people of the book, to borrow a phrase, and we're not organized. And most of us are pretty darn individual. We don't want to be all that organized.
I think as well, for me, as I was saying to you before we started our conversation proper, Lisa, this subject is something I'd kind of danced away from for quite a while, primarily because, for me, very similar in my rather idiotic presumptions, when I considered it to be alongside something as a subject such as the Fae and fairy lore, I think for anybody that's coming into this with either next to no knowledge or a certain cultural exposure to it, these days, when you look at how much stuff is out there on the internet, it's mind-blowing. It can really kind of set you back. And I think it's kind of a duality these days for me, I think. And you may agree or disagree with me, Lisa, that I think on one hand, it's a phenomenal that there are so many resources out there for anybody who wants to learn more about specific subjects or feels that they are gravitating towards paganism of a variety of denominations, whichever appeals to them. But I think often you can stumble across things and they can send you the wrong way, or they can just simply overwhelm you with the amount of information and knowledge that's there. Then, do you think that whilst it's easier for people to get into and connect to people and feel at one in this umbrella of paganism and the varieties of practitioners and practices and beliefs that fall under the umbrella, do you also think it's also harder for people to sort the wheat from the chaff and not get turned off by all the noise?
I think actually, interestingly, you've actually asked two different questions.
Nothing new.
No, it's good because So the interesting thing is, I think that while it's easier to find people who seem to be like-minded, social media alone, you can find thousands of groups with the word witch in the title. And there can be anywhere from hundreds to thousands of people in that group. But actually making a connection and feeling like you're more than just typing on a screen is actually incredibly difficult. And I say that as somebody who has a whole online presence and has for a number of years. I'm very well aware of how incredibly difficult it can be to actually connect with people, how much work that takes.
Mm.
It seems like you're connecting, but to actually get past the superficial is difficult.
Mm.
So that's kind of what I think about that. And I do think that gets in a way. I think it's, as I said earlier, it's sometimes people just have a hard time with having time to actually make connections. And so joining a group on social media can feel like, oh, I'm now doing a thing and I can now call myself a witch. And that works for a while. And that's very facile and very superficial. And you can get a lot of information, which leads me to the second part of that question. There's so much information out there. And yes, it can be incredibly difficult to sort out the wheat from the chaff. I mean, absolutely. There are unfortunately absolute places where there's just absolute garbage still out there. I think I don't think there's a whole lot of straight up predatory stuff going on anymore. But I know the minute I say that, listeners are going to be like, I can think of five places. So maybe that's me being a Pollyanna. but you know, I mean, I was actually just looking at a document today that was circulated on the BBS boards back in the late 80s. And it was a series of, quote, lessons in witchcraft. And the language of this document is victim blaming and shaming and non-inclusive and outdated in like just 100 ways. And it's just a 4-page document. That it's actually kind of a light to write a new version of that. So let me catch you up to what's actually going on in the world out. And, you know, in reference to the original and like, this is where I'm getting it from, but so y'all can know, but, that stuff still exists and people still share that as, oh, look, I just found this lesson and let's get together and we'll form our own study group and we'll teach each other witchcraft. Which, by the way, I mean, obviously, I did that. I have nothing against teaching yourself witchcraft. But when you use someone else's words without any kind of vetting, boy, you just got to be prepared to do the whole bootstrap thing. You just got to be prepared to fail a lot. And there are tried and true techniques and methods and paths that are well-worn. You don't need to go it alone completely, but finding those paths can feel difficult sometimes. Now, what I think is fascinating is that there are some people in paganism who will say that that's the whole point. They want to make it a little bit difficult because if you're not worthy, you won't find the path.
Mm.
Yeah, see, I say that out loud and we all kind of go, that doesn't feel good, that feels like a real old-fashioned kind of mentality of like you have to prove yourself before you're admitted. Then again, witchcraft is about learning yourself and taking responsibility for all of your actions, known and unknown, and accepting that you are changing the world around you all the time.
Yeah.
And there are consequences. You know, at its core, strip away all the religious apparatus, take God out of it or goddess out of it. And you've really got a system of saying, well, I learned that about myself. Oh, better go deal with it. No one else will. All right. And it never stops.
Yeah.
I mean, it never stops. I remember back back in the day when I got my third degree, I was like, oh, I've done my shadow work. And I look back on that, and it's like,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. And and it keeps coming. Someone may have given you a title or a ritual that said, hey, good work. It never stops, and it shouldn't ever stop.
Mm.
I mean, if you stop learning about yourself and your place in the world and how you are in the world and how the world is with you, then you're not in a really good place. You know, that's stagnant.
Yeah.
So the progress doesn't need to be super fast forward, but it does need to be progress towards something. And that's the end of my next lifetime, what that something is. Just kind of my joke, because, you know, I had many lifetimes before.
I think as well with your latest book, as we mentioned, A Witch's Guide to Crafting Their Practice, looking at how you designed the book and how you've wrote it and the way that you've attacked this subject, for me, Lisa, knowing your body of work prior to this, was this utilizing your teaching and the fact that you've been sharing your knowledge for over two decades in regards to people's guidance? Because there's a wonderful phrase in the introduction to the book, which simply says, it's a guidebook, not a rule book. And I think, as you've touched on there in regards to stumbling across the wrong path or all these self-proclaimed gatekeepers of knowledge, which I find deeply frustrating in a variety of linear and niche subjects that I tend to discuss with people. I'm one of those people that I have a real thirst for knowledge and I'm eager to devour things and learn things. But often for people outside of it who are probably just discovering certain strange topics, be it the paranormal or ufology or Wicca or the Fae, Lisa, I think if you take that wrong turning, you'll just run into a brick wall and you can't get any further, like you say. And so for me, the vast majority of people that I've spoken with and the books that I've read in the modern era in regards to the subject of Wicca and witchcraft and paganism seem to be very open, very welcoming, non-judgmental, and just not condescending. They're not treating people as though they've come in at degree level. But they're not talking to people as if they're children either. They're sort of saying, well, here you are, welcome. This is a very difficult subject if you want to go down that path. However, you don't have to learn everything tomorrow. You can take as long as you need. And therefore, when you've created this book, for me, it's got that whole feel of a very open and welcome introduction to the subject. It's knowledgeable, it's in depth, but it's not blowing people's minds with jargon and linguistics that perhaps is pushing people to stop every three pages to go on Google to find out what the hell does that mean? Where does that come from?
Thank you. That was absolutely what I was going for. Because yes, I have been talking to newcomers for two decades now. And, as a funny note, my original manuscript that I sent to Llewellyn, the publisher, was actually about four times longer than the final product we've produced. And they came back to me and they said, this is lovely. You've absolutely covered everything we could possibly want to know. It's too long. See, you need to cut it down. And so I sent them a second draft that was just half as long. And they're like, this is still really fantastic. You need to cut it again. It's still too long. And I'm not a particularly verbose writer, but what I had done was I took the whole year of training that I and my coven do, and I translated it from our virtual format into writing, and which was a wonderful process, actually. It's always hard writing, actually physically writing and putting the words down, but I really enjoyed the process of examining our coursework and it actually produce some changes in how we do things and think about some things, because, you know, I was looking at it from a very holistic level rather than module by module, which is how we teach it. So just imagine, this is, you know, what is in this book is basically the first third of our year, little bit kind of a thing. So we actually go into quite a bit more over the course of the year, but you can do that when you are working with people directly.
Yeah.
when you're actually writing things down, it's like, okay, I really want everyone to, just as you said, go at your own pace through this. Don't gobble it. It's meant to be in this chapter. Great. Okay, now we're ready for the next thing. Do this chapter.
Well,
and what I always think is really interesting is how other authors think about how they want to present this new information to people and where they start. Because the starting point is always really sets the tone for how things are going. And the thing I struggle most with is I wanted the first chapter to be about ethics. And I wavered between that and the Book of Shadows.
Hmm.
So it was just kind of funny. What we teach in the class is the Book of Shadows first, because you have to start your journey somewhere. And where you started is by writing it down.
Yeah.
By starting to keep track of what it is you're learning and what you're thinking about. And literally, the first thing we ask everyone to do is answer the question, why do you want to be a witch? Because almost guaranteed at the end of the year that we've spent together, the answer to that question is different.
Yeah.
And just one question can show an evolution in thinking and development. And it's a beautiful example of how you can really boil something down to something very simple that's profound. That's what I was going for with this. And as you know, from having read my other work, it's kind of funny that I've gone back to a beginner level, because my other books are not beginner level books. Virtual Pagan is a look at what it is like to be a pagan online, both of its developments. And, you know, Magical Connections is all about group dynamics and working within a group, which is, you know, advanced.
Yeah.
Level stuff. That's taking for granted you know how to do all the witch stuff. Now let's work together and how we're gonna, you know, get through the cycle of the year and the cycle of our development. So it was kind of nice for me to step back and get down to basics and re-examine the foundation work once again. It's been a while since I've had to do it for myself. And to be able to translate it from just being a teacher to being a writer was a nice process.
Hmm. When you come across newcomers or people that have expressed an interest in learning more, Lisa, are you often surprised how many people want to jump straight to practice and ignore everything to do with foundation? Because obviously, one of the key parts is that your book is essentially split into two portions. You've got a whole section dealing with a variety of aspects to the foundation before you even get to the practical. And I think often with anything, when someone's new to a subject, they will often try and run before they can walk. So is it still something that surprises you? Or do you just think most people, when they come to this subject, are desperately dying to get straight into their creating their altars or following their own deities or building their own paths or whatever sort of charms they wish to create, or even creating their own candles or whatever, rather than actually taking those first steps and learning about why they do these things rather than just wanting to do everything straight away?
I think there's value in jumping right into the practice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's harder in some ways, but I think there's a kind of a joy in just trying something and seeing how it goes. And I honestly think many people get into witchcraft because they want to do spell work.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, the ability to change one's reality is very seductive. I know it certainly appealed to my teenage self anyways. Because I felt like I was coming home. I was living in a world of chaos so many ways.
Yeah.
And, you know, the idea that I can actually exert some control.
Mm.
Whoa, hold on, stop the presses. I'm on board. Sign me up. And so I think what I actually have not a harder time with is that it's a little bit more difficult for me when I have students who absolutely don't want to do any energy manipulation or any energy work or magic at all because they're afraid of it. That's a much harder discussion and requires more effort on our part as teachers, because then we have to help them accept their own power, because magic is power.
Yeah.
And so someone who's afraid of that power has a lot going on. And that's somebody who's like, no, no, give me all the basic stuff. Give me all the steps first. I don't want to try that. Because that's, for them, that's advanced. And I think that's a little bit more difficult. There's more going on in the head on that one. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a more difficult place to work with when you have a practice that incorporates the idea of working magic, which I think is so fundamental to witchcraft in so many ways. Not necessary, but fundamental. Just as working with deity is not necessary, but for many, it's one of the more common aspects.
Yeah. I found the section dealing with deity very interesting because I think, once again, for people depending on their exposure to the subject, often they will fall into that trap of presuming that there is just one. Whereas clearly, one of the things I've learned over the last couple of years, Lisa, is that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of deities that you can designate as your chosen one. It's all what matters to you, and you can change. You don't have to be fixed. You can. It may be something that reflects that particular period in your life or why you've come to this subject and wanting to practice witchcraft in whichever form appeals to you. As you say, there are so many different aspects to it that, once again, I think people seem to think it's a one-size-fits-all and you follow every part of it. But not everybody, as you say, wants to do rituals and spells. Some people may just want to find a better connection with the world around them. They may want to work on energy. They may just want to deal with spellcraft. It's not everything for everyone, is it?
Exactly. Exactly. I was actually talking to a woman today who was talking about the fact that she asked me for guidance because she has spent a decade doing a very specific spiritual practice of working with tarot cards every day and doing goddess work in a very specific focused way and making physical offerings on a very regular basis. And it's a very intense spiritual practice. And she said to me, and just I've noticed in the last couple of months that I don't want to do that anymore.
Mm.
Now what? And it was like, okay, so let's talk. But my core advice to her ended up being, do something you haven't done before. If you've been doing all this intense stuff, say that your practice is now you go for a walk in the garden. Just do that. Don't do offerings. Don't do tarot cards. Don't do all that. Back off a bit and shift and see where that leads you. And I mean, I expect that we'll have a conversation over time, but you know, she's just gone fallow and that happens.
Mm.
You know, it's, you know, something has shifted. Her needs, her spiritual needs have shifted and she now needs to find what works for her now. And she has to figure that out. And that's a tough place.
Mm.
It happens to almost everybody, but it's a really tough place to go through because then you're like, oh, I've been abandoned. Now what? I failed. or something. And, you know, the dark night of the soul, as Jung put it so eloquently, as he does.
I think as well, as you say, and that touches on a variety of aspects of this, because once again, I think depending on where you're getting your information from, you can fall into these cliches almost, Lisa, that you have to have a specific type of altar. You have to practice a specific type of sacred space. You have to practice a specific type of meditation. You always have to make 10 minutes every day. And as we know, in the modern world, in the modern environment, that's simply not feasible for a lot of people. And I think too many people think that if they're not doing it enough or regularly, then they're not doing it right. Whereas, once again, it's one of those things, and reading your book validates that doesn't work for everybody. And therefore, why should you try and follow something that essentially becomes a chore?
Right. Right. I mean, it's not fun. If it doesn't bring you joy, oh, that's the part where I would say you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
You know, it should not be, you're right, it should not be a chore, you know, how you do things. And yeah, you know, I would say that if you want to participate in a very specific tradition, then yes, you should do things the way that tradition does things. I mean, that's where tradition, the word tradition comes from. And we have all these titles and these paths. All they're saying is that they have a core set of practices that they pass down greater or lesser specificity. So some traditions are very specific. You do it this way and only this way. And other traditions are more like, yeah, there's a framework that you work with. But they have core information that they share down from person to person to person. And that remains, you know, changed slowly, if you will, if at all. Actually, I think every tradition really changes or they die. But if you're not doing a specific tradition, which means by definition, if you're not working with a group that is in that tradition, because you can't do a tradition on your own, that doesn't work that way. Then, you know, if you're not doing that, then you should, I would hope that you could develop a practice that does bring you joy every day. Brings you fulfillment, brings you a sense of ease and comfort. And if it's appropriate, more of a connection to either deity or the world around you or things like that. I mean, there are several of my coven members who don't actively worship a deity. They're, as they call, non-theistic. They get the energy. They have no problem using a name in ritual. They're not like anti-deity, but they just don't have that connection with anything that they would label deity. They have that connection with the natural world. And so my particular tradition says, that's cool. We can all work together. Some traditions can't. Some traditions are like, here's the god, here's the goddess. That's it. Here's the name of the god. And here's the name of the goddess that we work with. They can be very specific. This is fun.
Do you think that still plays in, as you touched on earlier, in regards to the ethics of modern witchcraft, that there are still things that seem to have survived, such as the threefold law, for example? Are you surprised that these traditions are still so prevalent that people think that they have to follow it? Because obviously one of the other things, and without wishing to sort of sit on the fence here, one of the things I think that people misunderstand about modern witchcraft is that it's all good. But as far as I'm aware, as I said earlier on, it's a guidebook, not a rule book. There aren't any rules for that. So if you fancy doing something a bit mischievous, or you fancy throwing a hex or two about, what's to stop you? Surely.
There's nothing to stop you. You just have to be prepared to accept the consequences. I mean, which is my view entirely, actually. I am one of the people who feels that if a proper witch, you know, in my worldview and some my rules for myself, you have to be able to hex as much as you can heal, to borrow the phrase. But when I do, I am very aware that I may be taking on consequences unknown for doing that. And that's actually sort of the more subtle, complicated version of the threefold law, which like the reed has been sort of stripped of all of its rich history and connotation, so that everyone just thinks, well, you know, threefold, well, whatever you put back out comes back to it threefold. So, and there's this weird little kind of shaming thing going on, or no, not shaming, that's not the right word, but, you know, like if you do bad, more bad's gonna come at you, you know, so never think a negative thought or have a negative emotion, that kind of thing, which I don't think is healthy. That's not very human. And that's not even something you really want to aspire to, because we are made up of our shadow as much as our bright sides. And our goal in life is to learn to accept all of ourselves in the enormity, in the gloriousness of it, and then move forward. And so we have a law, quote unquote, the threefold law. It says whatever you put out is going to come back. Well, I mean, you know, the math on that's really easy, right? Like, oh, I better be good all the time. The good comes to me.
Yeah.
You know, and it's very simple. It's very naive. And it's not a really healthy way to kind of go through life. And it's because it's not what the threefold law originally meant. You know, and so, and we've lost that history, and that, going back to your earlier point, that's one of the things that's happened with all the vast amount of information that's out there, because someone stripped it down once and that essay now been shared a million times. It's in every book of shadows that you find online, and everyone thinks that's the rule going to that too. And the read. You know, it's actually one of my favorite things to tell people about, and I'm so glad I got a chance to put it in this book. But, you know, Gartner did say, and at Farm None, do what you will. But he was talking very specifically about when can't do magic, not when you move through your life.
Yeah.
And that's been lost when everyone talks about the read. But it's like it completely shifts how you look at those eight words. Because trying to live at Farm None every day, when you get right down to it, that's impossible. We eat food, therefore we're harming.
Yeah.
There it end of story. So, but if it's just in terms of magic, and even then he meant it, you just be aware of what you're doing. Be aware of your consequences, not don't ever hurt. He was fine with hexing.
Mm.
You know, he was talking much more about fitting, you know, being honest about what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah.
More than anything else. And I think I've wandered a little bit from the topic. Sorry.
That's all right. Don't apologize. You're fine. I think this is one of the aspects because, as I mentioned earlier, you can follow your own path once you get through the foundation into the practices that, as you were saying, give you the most satisfaction on a variety of levels. And it may be when we talk about things like meditation, people just presume you have to sit in a darkened room for 30 minutes just trying to find your own space. But not everybody can do that. Not everybody has that kind of brain activity. I'm one of those people, Lisa, that I find it very hard to have a settled head for some reason. And even when people, my idea of relaxing is just sitting down for half an hour and then I'll go up and do a small chore and then I'll sit back down again. And then half an hour later, I'll do something else. But for me, that's relaxing because I'm not doing it all the time. Whereas some people may say that that's not relaxing. That's the opposite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are people who neurologically cannot sit still. You know, so the idea of meditating is, you know, just frustrates them because they have this idea of, you know, you have to sit still and gaze into the distance or not think anything. But no, it's perfectly valid to meditate while moving. Go for a walk. You know, it's just, if you're clearing your head, if you're shutting down the chatter in your head, that's there you're heading towards meditation right there. You know, and it may not be the Buddha, but you're still clearing your brain and making space for silence, making space for the call and your unconscious to speak to you a little bit, your intuition to speak to you. It's actually one of my favorite forms of meditation is actually doing artwork.
Yeah.
I mean, you can lose yourself in craft and painting or needlework or, you know, something. You just lose yourself and time goes by. Well, that's meditation.
Yeah.
You know, it's good for your brain to do that. It's calming for your brain, especially in modern society, which has so many distractions all the time. So much noise, literally noise all the time. It can be hard to, I think sometimes it's really hard for people to actually sit or be in silence because it's unusual and a little scary. And that might almost be the true benefit of meditation. Is to learn to have silence and allow space for it in whatever way. Now, I've had mothers as students over the years who had small children and they have come to me and said, there's no way I'm going to sit quietly for 15 minutes. If my child is sleeping, I'm sleeping or I'm getting caught up on the thing that didn't get done because they were awake. So what am I supposed to do with this? And I said, do you go to the bathroom? Do you take a shower? They're like, yeah, like, okay, take a few extra minutes in the bathroom and just sit and breathe. Take a few extra minutes in the shower and sit and just be in that moment. And if you give yourself 2 minutes, 5 minutes a day, you're golden. That's all I'm ever going to ask of you. And, you know, that works. You can have 2 minutes behind a locked door. You know, 2 minutes more, I should say, beyond the time you're doing your business, right? So it doesn't have to be an elaborate practice. It doesn't have to be lighting incense and chanting and sitting in a salt position or anything like that. I mean, those things are lovely, obviously, but that doesn't have to be the goal by far.
Even something as simple as going for a walk can often help. Like you say, I mean, I'm very fortunate where I live. We've got some beautiful parks. Even for myself, I wouldn't consider it to be meditation. Lisa, but I always feel better for having a walk amongst the trees, even if it's just hearing the birds sing and just wandering around and taking in the sights and just wandering. I find it deeply therapeutic, which some people go, oh, well, that sounds really boring. But it works for me. It might not work for you, but at the end of the day, if it doesn't work for you, I don't really care. It works for me.
Exactly. Exactly. Losing yourself in music can be lovely. There are times when a nice therapeutic rock song played very loud is great.
Yeah.
The air clearing of the brains.
What I liked about the practice portions of the book, amongst many other things, is that there are exercises that you've put at the end of each section, but also, which is very rare, you've put a collection of problems that people may come across, which I find, once again, as we're talking about the level sometimes books are pitched at, they'll say, right, if you do this, this is it. And they don't think about, as with anything, any form of education is not going to work for everybody in the same way. Some people are more visual. Some people can take the written word in easily as anything, whereas other people really struggle just to kind of focus and may have to reread sections over and over again until it sticks. But if they see it as a diagram or a picture, they get it immediately. So I found it very refreshing to see that you do tell people, well, this might go wrong. And if it does, so what? It's just one of those things. It's that, once again, it's that, well, if you don't do it this way, and it goes wrong or it doesn't work, then you're not doing it right. Not the fact that you might not be used to doing it. You might not be in the situation. You might not be in the right mindset to do it. So that, would you say that it's important to make people realize that they might start giggling, or they might not make the ink correctly, or they might not craft the spell right, or they might write something down incorrectly rather than thinking, oh, I've done it wrong, I'm stupid.
Right. I mean, absolutely. I think it's incredibly vital, because there's so little, it's so rare to actually do something catastrophic, magically speaking. I mean, you almost have to work at it to really do it. I mean, because what ends up happening, you know, to use a real world example sort of, is, you know, if you forget to call a quarter, your circle doesn't hold energy well or correctly, and everything feels really wonky. And I mean, it does, and people don't feel connected. And if you were trying to do magic, like you're trying to raise power and send it, you know, towards a specific purpose, you probably will just fail.
Yeah.
Okay. But the likelihood that you're going to, by not calling a quarter, anger that elemental is really small. Really, really, really small. Now, if you stand with that quarter and shout insults at it, well, you're asking for trouble. But that's like with any relationship. If you walk up to your spouse and you start insulting them, you deserve what you're about to get. That's, you know, that's all I have to say. But we all tend to go around trying to anger the people we have relationships with. So, you know, and when we make mistakes in a healthy relationship, you know, the other person goes, well, you made a mistake and I'm not happy. You know, maybe sometimes you got to make it up to them, but then you move on. And so if you call a deity wrong, yeah, you might piss him off. I mean, seriously, if you were to call, I don't know, Hecate and Bast in the same ritual, you really got to word it correctly, because those two do not like each other. They're from different pantheons. They have very antagonistic ruling, you know, domains that they rule over. They don't like each other. So if you're going to invite both of them to a, you know, relatively speaking, a party, well, you're mixing up that energy in a very particular kind of way. And one or the other of them might even agree with you, but most likely not. Most likely they're just not going to come the next time you call.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you know, and I guess maybe it's simplistic of me, but that's, I do actually think that our relationship with the natural world and with deity is a relationship.
Yeah.
And if you practice good habits, it's a good relationship. You know, it's not an equal partnership, but it's also not one where they expect you to grovel. That's kind of weird, as it would be in a relationship, a romantic relationship.
Yeah.
So, you know, treat them with respect. do your best. When you mess up, say, I'm sorry, and move on. You know, I have called court. I have even recently created circles and called a quarter where I have done it in the wrong order for what we're supposed to do. And we dealt with the energy that came up. I mean, we just, you know, it was like, okay, do we stop? Do we do it? We go forward? No. Okay. And we decided to go forward. And yeah, it was weird. it was odd. It was weird. I don't think I angered anybody. And I certainly, everyone else showed up for ritual the next time we did it. So, you know, it happens. It happens to people who've been doing rituals for 40 years. They just kind of achieve things. It's not perfect. You know, sometimes you knock the candle over and suddenly you're putting out a fire, which is deeply distracting. And yes, you're going to break circle by running out and getting a glass of water to put the fire out.
Yeah.
That's okay. You didn't break the world.
I think there is this fear of making mistakes, Lisa. And I think one of the key aspects of your book is it's very understanding in regards to the fact that if you get it right, so there'll always be somebody who'll make me look silly when I say this, but most of the time people don't get things right the first time. It's practice, as with anything. And I think when you have subjects such as these that people are coming into and they're extremely eager to learn or to please or to show what they've developed, I think sometimes there is this fear, as with anything. I think, as you've referred to there, it's being honest and humble enough to know that even the best of us will still make mistakes, no matter how experienced we are, because we're only human. It happens. And therefore, it's just one of those things. Don't be afraid of making mistakes. Don't be afraid of doing something wrong. It happens.
I absolutely agree. One of the key things our class does is we do ritual with the students right at the start of the year. And the first couple of rituals, they don't take a role. They just watch. They are participants, and the coven shoulders all the burdens. And then right after that, they start taking small roles. Maybe it's just a speaking line. Maybe it's a quarter call if they're feeling like they can stand up to that. And because we feel it's really important to start using the information we're giving them right away. And they get to see actual people doing actual things. So when, you know, they get to actually read about creating sacred space, for example, they've seen us do it. They have context for what they're reading about and what they're learning about, what that lesson is bringing forward. And, you know, so they've actually done it before they read about it, which is a little bit backwards, but you can only give so much information all at once. Yeah, we do have to progress over a line because we live in a linear time zone. But, and I think it's really important because they get to see us mess up as well from time to time. That's all there is. And I have had students over the years who've been like, I don't want to take a part in ritual. I don't want to mess it up. And there's always gentle encouragement to just take this line. It's three sentences. Just take this part. You're not calling any energy. You're not doing anything. You're just saying some things. And, you know, baby steps, little toes in the water kind of a thing. We have that place for people who want to hold off a little bit. We also have places for people who are like, you know, I've done some work before. I've been reading for years. I worked with this other group that was very scattered, whatever. It's like, okay, come on in. We've got a role for you too. Let's move forward because you've got more information and more practice under your belt. I would like people to feel comfortable with trying things out. You asked earlier, you know, whether I think it's a bad idea for people to just jump right in. I think, like I said, I think a lot of people get into witchcraft because they want to do a spell. They need money at the last minute. They want someone to fall in love with them. Very classic. They want to advance at work. And, you know, so lighting a candle and doing some intent focus and maybe burning some incense produces money out of nowhere. And then you're up. I mean, not really, obviously, but it can feel that way sometimes. You know, there's always some spark for people. There's always something that got them interested in whatever it was. And I don't, it's very rarely random. It's very rarely just, you know, being a made fly, you know, and interested in just something for a day and then moving on to something else. And, you know, and if it is, okay, great. Then they got what they wanted. They moved on. So this isn't for them.
Yeah. Do you still come across people who, when they join your course or they take their first steps in this realm, Lisa, that they come in with a preconceived idea of how they're supposed to dress or how they're supposed to look? And you see the sort of graduation as they realize that they don't have to fit into a specific style or look it's a state of mind. It's not a statement of appearance.
It does happen. I think it happens less with appearance. So much as there'll be some lesson or another where they feel like they've got to do it right. And honestly, I think the biggest one for most people is the Book of Shadows. Because, you know, we have these wonderful movies that show us these gorgeous handwritten drawings and pictures and exploded diagrams and incredibly beautiful scripts and all this kind of stuff. And they think that they've got to put the information in right.
Yeah.
And they have to be careful about what they put in because, you know, they've got a lot of things. And as you know, that's a lot of my chapter about the Book of Shadows is just really like, relax. Whatever you do will be good because the important part is the doing. But I do have a lot of students that they get very hung up and they'll buy a beautiful book with a weather bound, you know, handmade leather cover. And then they'll be paralyzed by the white pages. You know, what do I put down? It's just like, just start writing, just put something in there or paste the picture in. Or I recently got introduced to these little mini printers that print little, you know, 2.5 inch by 2.5 inch square photos. It's been like, oh, look what I can put in my Book of Shadows, actual color. Because my Book of Shadows is just writing. And I'm trying to develop a more artistic side. So I try to draw things and not have judgment. That's my current thing, is not having judgment about it. So here, see, look, decades in, I'm still struggling with what I put in my Book of Shadows. So I really feel when people get hung up on it. But these little printers just allow me to literally take a picture of anything, like my churro spread, you know, a card, a flower, you know, an image of a bird or something that sparked something for me. I don't have to recreate it. I can still get imagery in. And that's been really fun for me to explore and, you know, develop that, you know. So I'm still learning, doing new things. I mean, I have all of my Book of Shadows from all of these years, and they're fascinating. They're really, really fascinating. What I put in my first books was so sweet. It really reflects that my age and the time was in many ways. Yeah.
Well, even on that level, I suppose they're very important culturally and socially, because obviously it shows you the change as a person and a witch, Lisa, as you've developed and learned and become comfortable in your own skin. Obviously, I suppose looking back, it's interesting to see from where you started to where you've got to, that it is a development. And as we've said several times, the one thing about life is you're always learning things. Once you think you know everything, that's when things usually blow up in your face, or you make mistakes, or things just don't start going right for you. And I think once you lose that appetite or that thirst for knowledge or that humility to know that you can never know it all, you're always learning regardless. Every conversation we have, every place we visit, every time we go somewhere, we learn something, whether we realize it or not.
Absolutely. That is my core ideal in life at this point. It was not always, but it's really what I've come to over the years. And I think it's the most important thing. It's what keeps us interesting. It's what keeps us young in our heads. And it's what keeps us from getting stagnant in so many ways. And my journals are precious. give as a side note here, when I moved to Portugal, part of the process of doing that, which is about a year ago now, I sold, my husband and I, we sold our house. We sold all of our possessions. 25 years in one house. We sold everything. We moved to Portugal with basically 8 suitcases and a handful of boxes of personal possessions, most of which, by the way, were occult books and Minecraft supplies. But two of those bins, really big bins, are my germs.
Yeah.
I mean, they, you know, of everything else I got rid of, those are still coming. Mm-hmm. And they will follow me through my life. And I have no idea what I will do with that when I die. But that's for another day. And hopefully I will have a legacy to leave it to in terms of my covet.
Mm-hmm.
But they're with me because they show a life.
Yeah.
Now, maybe someone else will find it interesting someday. Maybe not.
Well, I'll see. To be honest, I'm not surprised in the slightest. Now, that to me, knowing you and your work and speaking with you today, Lisa, I would have been more surprised if you'd have relinquished those than a television, because at the end of the day, it's a television. Those are very personal benchmarks in your life. You can see everything that you've been through over the years by just delving into those books. So I would not be shocked or surprised in the slightest to hear that. And to be honest, and I would have been disappointed if he had.
I would have been as well, actually. So yes, because you're right. Television is easily replaced. I mean, all the physical possessions, yeah, no big deal, or they're not necessary.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that was deeply necessary for me was a laptop.
Yep.
And just like, nope, I got a laptop and my journals. I'm good. And clothes. Yeah. But yeah, that was really it.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Well, the last thing I want to touch on before I let you go is your previous book to this one was an updated version of one of your first, which is Virtual Pagan. Now, I'm deeply interested in hearing about the changes here, Lisa, because as we were saying, I'm one of those people. I got online 1998, I think. In those days where you had to sit and wait for a minute for anything to appear on your screen, it made a god-awful noise.
Oh yeah, the modem. Oh, I remember modems.
I remember the excitement of having half a meg broadband.
Oh, yeah. Wow!
Things appear in 3 seconds and being able to download something in less than a day. So I'm very interested because I think the Virtual Pagan came out in 2002. It's 20 years ago. I think when we say things like that, we go, oh, "Well, it was only 20 years ago," and you think, actually,
yeah,
we're talking, and without wishing to sound presumptuous to the listeners, I mean, sometimes it amazes me that people forget that YouTube didn't exist, Facebook didn't exist, Twitter didn't exist. The things that everybody uses every day, near enough, weren't there. I think MySpace had only just started. So when we think back to how things were online 20 years ago compared to where it was, do you think it was a necessary updation that you had to do because everything had changed in 20 years online, I would suspect?
Absolutely. I mean, it was so necessary. You know, at the beginning of the pandemic, so early 2019, I had a sense of vindication because for years, people had been telling me that it was impossible to do magic online. You could not do ritual online. You could not teach people magic online. And over the course of a year and a half or so, suddenly everyone had to move online. and it took me longer than I had hoped. I didn't end up republishing the Virtual Pagan until early 2021, but by which point things were starting to open back up again. And so it wasn't quite as relevant. But yes, things that we predicted in 2000 for what paganism online was going to look like, a new frontier of what was going to be happening and stuff, in so many ways was just dead well.
Mm.
But in fascinating ways was still working out just in a completely different guise than we expected. And that was social media.
Yeah.
Because you're right, MySpace had just started to stretch its legs a little bit. We had the beginning of online dating. The really early online dating things were happening. So people were starting to learn how to make connections through, you know, this virtual world. I mean, and BBSs had been around, you know, since the 90s, obviously.
Yeah.
Back in 2002, when it published, I was actually ready in 2000, you know, I was able to talk about these things because these new things that were happening, and virtual community was beginning to be something that like sociology was starting to talk about, because people had been doing virtual community on Genie for years, and the AOL chat rooms turning. I mean, like, because people were like, oh, this is how we can have like real time talk. And yeah, I know we laugh now. but that's very much what the virtual pagan was about. And a lot of the book, because it was so new, I mean, like, there's a whole chapter on how to find other pagans. There's a chapter on how to set up your technology so that you can talk to other people and find information, how to do an FTP download. You know, that's what I was talking about in the original one. Plus also the politics of working with other people online and how to create connections, real connections with people in this new environment. You never actually look at them, and some in the anonymity and such. So, you know, 20 years later, it was so ripe for being able to go back and say, okay, this is what's different. Mm. And this is what has actually worked out. And what has worked out is, no, we don't have a lot of covens working online. We don't have a lot of traditions working online. Back in 2000, you found thousands of websites for covens that were going to be cyber covens. That doesn't exist anymore. The version of it that does exist is social media. All those groups and social media are functioning in the way that many of those old groups that call themselves covens were functioning, which is information sharing and giving you a place to be yourself, whatever that looked like,
yeah,
out of a witchy way, whatever that means for people. But there still are not actually a lot of groups that are training or communicating online, using the virtual environment as part of their magical tradition.
Hmm.
There just aren't. And so I got that dead wrong, because I really did think that a lot more of that was going to happen, mostly because, you know, the great benefit of working virtually is you can work asynchronously, and it doesn't matter what your geography is. The hardest part about geography is time zones.
Yep.
When you're virtual. Mm. And I feel that very much right now. I'm in Portugal, so I'm actually 8 hours ahead of some of my coven members in the Pacific Northwest.
Yep.
And we had always done our meetings and rituals and stuff at 6 p.m. Pacific time. Then people were called from work and such like that. Which is 2 a.m. for me.
Yes.
So I now get up at 2 a.m. and do ritual or teach.
Yeah.
It's fascinating. But other than that, it doesn't matter whether my classmates or coven members are in Canada or United States, anywhere in the United States, or Europe. The only ones we actually ever have real difficulty with are when we have someone from like Australia or Japan.
Yes.
Because they're so very far off.
Yep.
It's just very, very difficult to work with them and make that happen. Not impossible, but difficult.
Hmm.
So the Virtual Pagan 2.0, what I did was I actually took out those chapters on technology and how to find people. And I put them in the appendix because I find them charming.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of important that people, they're historical to a certain sense.
Hmm.
But what has happened that I'm touched on a little bit, but it's gotten so vitally important, is the issues of security and privacy and anonymity. And the other thing people forget is that, you know, the turn of the century, the internet was seen as this wonderful source of equality and sharing of information, so that you weren't hidebound to whatever your geographical location was. You could find the answers to what you need. You could talk to people at universities. There, you know, it was this great big frontier of information. But now, as you touched on a number of times in this talk with us, there's so much information and there's no vetting.
Yeah.
There's no process by which you know whether it's accurate or not. There are websites that are just what they call honey traps, that are just there to scrape your information.
Yeah.
You know, we never could have imagined the data mining that goes on and the money that get made on tracking what we do online. So that's a huge part of what I talk about now, because I think it's really important for pagans, other people in marginal worlds. You know, you don't want the world to know that you are interested in witch books. How do you protect yourself when you want to go find that information?
Yep.
You know, that kind of a thing. So that was a big update. So here's really large part of it. And it's why it took me so long, because I actually had to, go talk to experts and get good information to pass along, fish shaving, all the scams and such that are going on so far beyond the Nigerian prince.
Yes.
You know, those scams from the old days, which,
that's still
that's incredible.
But I like to check my spam folder on the show, Lisa, because I probably get 5 emails like that a day still. And it always makes me chuckle that I just think, is there anybody in the world left who hasn't received one of these emails?
Yeah.
Does anybody fall for it? Surely they must, I would imagine.
They do. They do, unfortunately. Just enough, 0.001% of people do. And there's just enough money in that to really track it down. Yeah. It's sad, unfortunately.
But. It is. Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your conversation today. It's been delightful and enlightening. Where can everybody get a hold of your work and follow you online on your presences?
Well, my work can be found at any bookstore, you know, the big ones, as well as your local independent. I'll always prop for the local independent bookstores. If they don't have it, go in and ask, and they can order it very easily. The Virtual Pagan is only available, unfortunately, through Amazon and Barnes & Noble at this time. But you can get hard copy or Kindle, you get the electronic version there at any time, as is Magical Connections, my other book on group dynamics and how to work in magical groups. You could always find me online at the very easy to remember lisatherucherry.com. I have a blog there and information about any appearances I might do or things that are coming up will be there. My review site is facingnorth.net. And my class, for anyone who might be interested, is jaguarmoon.org.
Fabulous. So I'll put links to everything in the show notes for the episode, as usual, as I do for all my guests. And Lisa, thank you so much for your time, your conversation, and your trouble today.
This has indeed been a pleasure, Paul. Really, I've enjoyed it.